Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of March 28th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well, D.R. Thank you so much for being here. So, D.R., for the last several years, climate hawks have been fighting the good fight against something called the Keystone XL pipeline, and in fact succeeded in presenting so many problems to both the Keystone XL pipeline developers and to the then good president of the United States, Mr. Barack Obama, that ultimately Obama rejected the application of the Keystone XL pipeline to cross the Canadian border. So if anybody's listening that is not familiar with this, the idea is the Keystone XL will be brought down from Canada and route itself down to New Orleans and put this horribly toxic gelatin of tar sands through many thousands of miles of pipeline across the Ogallala Aquifer, et cetera, et cetera. But primarily it has to cross the American border from Canada to the U.S., and hence the president gets to say whether or not that happens or not. And Mr. Obama made the wise choice not to let it happen for environmental reasons, et cetera, et cetera. But tell me, DR, in the last few days, what's the latest outrage from the Trumpian insanity that we seem to be involved in?
Well, it has been reported that the Trump administration will approve the Keystone XL oil pipeline, at least on a federal level, but as Politico notes, it still has to run through a lot of state-level obstacles. The company, quote, still needs the approval from the Nebraska Public Service Commission to approve the pipeline's route through the state. The decision is expected in late September. Bold Alliance, the group that formerly known as Bold Nebraska that has protested the pipeline, is seeking local residents to file as interveners in the process in an effort to block route approval. There's still eminent domain issues, as landowners in the state don't necessarily want their land taken. So there's still various state-level legal issues that will be involved, but obviously from a federal level, the path is expected to be cleared.
Well, tell me, why is it, if Obama made a report based on, Obama's State Department made the report and decided that on balance the environmental damage was worse than the benefits. Is it true? Is there no legal recourse to object to the current president's decision?
I do recall at the time when Obama rejected the Keystone XL pipeline, there was a lot of reports at the time that a subsequent administration could simply go right in and reverse that decision.
Really?
Without running through a lot of legal obstacles. So that may be what is going on here. Although, you know, there is a lot of bluffing, and obviously we do recall the speculation that this pipeline may not be built by virtue of the fact that there's not an economic benefit because of the changes in oil prices. So therefore, you know, after all this bluster and after all this hot air talk, it may never get built after all.
Right, that's a good point. I mean, in addition to the local Nebraska opposition led by Janet Klieb, who was a speaker at the MCAN conference a couple of years ago, right? I mean, the whole local landowner opposition is still real, and the economics are now against it, right? Tar sands are very expensive. So just, again, to remind everyone, to turn the tar sands into oil, you have to grind the literally sand with some tar in it. And you have to grind that all up, boil it, boil out the tar, and then somehow transport that heavy stuff somewhere and further refine it. It's very expensive to do, and actually energy intensive. In order, I think you have to put in 2 barrels of oil to get 3 barrels of oil out of it, right? I mean, it's so economically it might not make sense in an age where natural gas is relatively cheap, huh?
Exactly. And there'll be you know, similar protests. The Washington Post noted that Bill McKibben will lead protests against this. There are going to be any number of groups that will continue to you know, lead the charge against this. This is a fight that is far, far from over.
And the hypocrisy of the whole thing of President Trump there saying that we're going to build the Keystone XL pipeline with American steel, when in fact it's going to be built with Russian steel, just once again brings up the whole unpleasant connection that, you know, is multiple podcasts unto itself of Mr. Trump and his friends in the Borscht Belt, I guess we should say. Oh, my God. All right. Well, okay. So anyway, Keystone XL back on track due to the incompetence and lack of vision of our current president. But then speaking of leaders in high places doing stupid things, let me just set the story up, DR, and you can complete it. Of course, Rex Tillerson was the head of Exxon. Of course, Exxon being our favorite villain as an oil company because it seems to personify all the bad things. But Rex Tillerson was head of Exxon, and Exxon knew that climate change was real in the 70s, but hid it from its shareholders. And so people like the Attorney General of New York, Mr. Schneiderman, and the Attorney General of Massachusetts have sued Exxon because they think they've defrauded consumers in Massachusetts. Right? And so then there's a legal battle that goes back and forth that, long story we don't need to get into, but between Exxon and these two attorneys general from the Northeast, the attorneys general seem to have the upper hand in that the court has ordered that Exxon provide lots and lots of documentation, sort of this discovery process, to the attorneys general. So as part of that, it's a lot of emails. It turns out that, well, you take the story from there, DR. I mean, that's so there we are. Exxon is supposed to turn over all the emails related to climate, right?
Yes. Subsequently, it came out that there were some emails under the name of Wayne Tracker that Rex Tillerson were sending to other officials at Exxon discussing climate change and other issues. Exxon is now claiming that those emails, which a New York judge has ordered the company to turn over, some of those emails have gone missing. Now, let's note the irony that Tillerson is working for a guy who made a big deal about Hillary Clinton's missing emails, and all of a sudden, his company and his own emails have also gone missing. Where are those emails? Where could they be?
Where could they be? Now, it's just fascinating because Mr. Rex Tillerson, tell me, DR, what is Rex Tillerson's middle name?
Wayne.
What a romantic name, Wayne Tracker. So that I guess that plays both ways, right? Wayne Tracker is just kind of a name on its own, but if you want to know where Wayne, the CEO, is, you can just send an email to Wayne Tracker. Sort of like Flight Tracker, right? See where your wife is flying, where your wife is flying back and forth to California. But then Exxon, for all of its vaunted technological, and after we've damned poor Hillary Clinton for her email debacle for 18 months, Exxon goes belly up and can't find these emails anymore. Well, what a miracle, right? I mean, what a surprise. The emails that might reveal what Rex Wayne Tillerson actually knew about climate have vanished the way you hit that delete button once and boom, it's gone, right?
And something tells me these are the sort of emails that will never appear on WikiLeaks.
Yeah, somehow I don't think Mr. Putin wants to release those emails. But, I mean, still in all, I guess there are some emails that have been recovered. So just to be, you know, all I know is what I read in the papers, right? But some of the emails have been found. But the point of the matter is that the state's attorney general from New York and Massachusetts should be given all of the emails from Exxon to begin with, plus whatever emails that were secretively sent back and forth by Mr. Wayne Tracker, the romantically named Wayne Tracker, when he talked about how much he hated climate change and how he was really worried that Exxon was going to ruin the world, right? I'm being sarcastic, but there you go. So we'll keep an eye on that. I just think it's, I don't know. The irony
it does raise the question,
deep.
Should we have a positive outlook that they will be able to find these emails?
Yeah, I think they gave the they gave that computer, the server, to somebody in a sledgehammer and said, go out in the parking lot and make sure this thing doesn't work anymore. Oh, God. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. So there's that. But then there's some hopeful news or some sort of uplifting news. There's a couple ways to go. First of all, let's talk about what happened in India. Right. Mm-hmm. So the report is kind of sparse. It's in The Guardian. But just as backdrop, about a year, 18 months ago, I forget, in New Zealand, right? The people of New Zealand and the tribes that were there ancestrally, but New Zealand granted to a national park, I think it was, or a river that ran through a national park, it granted to that river personhood, mm-hmm. in the sense that that was a person which could go to court and be defend its rights just as a human would. And, of course, there was some sort of human assigned to be the spokesperson for the river. But this is a breakthrough where a piece of the earth is actually given legal rights approximating that of a human being. Mm-hmm. And so at the time we all said, what a great thing. It turns out that this past week in India, of all places, the Ganges River, which, of course, is the spiritual home of Hinduism and all kinds of stuff in India, right? Mm-hmm. The Ganges mm-hmm. has been given a human status as well. Did you see that?
Yes, the Guardian noted that the Ganges River has become, quote, the first non-human entity in India to be granted the same legal status as people. A court in the northern Indian state of Uttarakhand ordered that the Ganges and its main tributary, the Yamuna, be accorded the status of living human entities. Now, that's interesting from two perspectives. Number one, if now that this river has the same legal status as people, does that mean that legal representatives of the rivers have standing to sue the coal industry in India for, you know, obviously, you know, inflicting damage upon the river? And number two, We have, you know, as far-fetched as this may seem from a United States perspective, but we've brought up the issue of the late U.S. you know, Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, who in his dissent, I believe in a case known as Sierra Club versus Morton in 1972, basically said that, you know, plants and animals and anything any element of nature that is affected by man's behavior should have legal status to defend itself. So it's interesting how this concept, which is scoffed at in the United States, is embraced in India and New Zealand.
And I think you're right. I mean, I think that since the river evidently, so I know I'm sort of talking through my head because I don't know, but it seems like since the river is accorded human status, another human can speak in its behalf. And what I read somewhere is that there were two or three people that were appointed as guardians, you know, the people that act in the interest of the river, and that there was lots and lots of pollution that different plants up and down the river that were polluting the Ganges, and those were targets of coming lawsuits in defense of the human person of the Ganges.
Exactly. And again, you know, if a river has legal rights, it should be able to defend itself. It is being trespassed upon you know, polluters.
So and I guess, I mean, if William O. Douglas made the argument that, let's just say, elements of nature deserve a voice in legal proceedings. I think that's the most general way I could say to reiterate what you were saying. Mm-hmm. What in the United States would you pick out to be most worthy of humanhood? I guess I haven't thought about that. I mean, would it be the Grand Canyon? Would it be the Mississippi River?
I would think it would be the Missouri River that's under threat in regarding the whole Standing Rock controversy. Mm-hmm. If that river had been accorded legal standing, then, you know, this whole controversy would be resolved in favor of the water protectors, would it not be?
Yeah, anyone who's listening who has an idea of what we should have a contest of what the most likely to be a human what part of the U.S. Of land is most likely to become a human first would be an interesting discussion. And what would have, I mean, what would have the iconic gravitas? Anyway, so that's an interesting concept of again, granting human status to parts of nature. So, DR, I saw something this week that I got a kick out of because it brought me back to days of, I don't know, somewhere between eighth grade and sophomore in high school, comparing our current moment not to the book 1984, right? Our current political environment, not to George Orwell's 1984 as the most appropriate analogy, but rather to a book called The Lord of the Flies as the most appropriate kind of political analogy to the state that we're in. And for those of you who haven't reached eighth grade yet, or maybe never had the pleasure of reading The Lord of the Flies, it's a story about basically a bunch of kids that somehow end up on an island, probably as a consequence of a nuclear war somewhere, but there's just these young kids on an island, and basically how they build a society and how that society breaks down into open warfare. And they essentially have what amounts to a constitution, an agreement on how they're going to govern themselves. And I forget the guy's name, Ralph, I think was the guy, the character, who comes in and basically attacks the way things work, and it ends up in a bad way. And of course, I won't surprise anyone, but at the end, the British Navy sails in and picks up all the kids, right? But even when as a young kid reading, I remember getting to the end of the book and saying, okay, what British Navy is going to come save humanity from itself, right? So anyway, there was that. But tell me, DR, you mentioned before that you had seen a different book that had some relevance to our current time.
This pertains to a discussion that on Tuesday the 28th, Bill McKibben is scheduled to lead at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline regarding the novel The Grapes of Wrath. There's going to be a screening of the movie, and then he's going to discuss, you know, the book and the movie within the context of climate change, within the context of extreme drought, within the context of environmental injustice.
Well, GR, and before I tell me the story of The Grapes of Wrath. For those people who, again, who may not have had the pleasure of reading it when they were in high school.
It's been a long time since I've read it. Basically, about those, you know, suffering through the Great Depression and suffering through extreme drought and trying to move.
It's people in Oklahoma who are in the Dust Bowl, and they decide they're going to move to the promised land of California. And it's a story of their journey across the you know, from Oklahoma to California, being called Okies and insulted and attacked. And it's basically this human story of suffering and triumph through adverse conditions, right? So, I mean, it is quite relevant because as drought hits California now, right, and the rest of and the planet is changing, this is a story that's relevant, right? So continue.
Definitely. And McKibben is going to discuss this. He was interviewed by the Boston Globe, and he noted, you know, that the sort of the extreme weather in Oklahoma today, in Kansas today, and in California today, and that there's, and therefore this book is, quote, not just a historical document, but also a document about how our current world with this depiction of drought and its effects, unquote. So it'd be very, very interesting to see how McKibben puts it within the climate context.
Now that's tonight. If this is Tuesday the 28th, then it's tonight, and it's in Coolidge Corner Theater someplace, right?
In Brookline, yes.
In Brookline, which is probably part of the Brookline Climate Week. We'll put up a link to the whole thing. If you've never been into Coolidge Corner in Brookline, it is a pretty cool place. I used to live in the neighborhood, and it is a pretty nice place. Oh, dear. So we haven't even gotten to half of the things. The big topic that I wanted to talk about we'll have to delay for another week because there's just too many. You're too entertaining a storyteller, DR.
Thanks.
So let me remind everybody, we've got April 29th is the march in D.C. If you haven't signed up for a bus, go looking for it. I'll put up the links to it. Get ready for that. There is, of course, on April 22nd, the week before, is the Scientist March, which is both in D.C. and in satellite places around the country. So there you go. Those are things that are coming down the pike. You can see, let's see, Tomorrow night in Brookline, Carol Oldham, the executive director of MCAN, will be talking about activism in our state and what you can do at the local level. So check that out. So, DR, I'll put up links to most of what we talked about in the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. Please share us with your friends. Please tweet about us. There is a hashtag called Tripod, #Tripod, T-R-Y-P-O-D, that encourages people to listen to new podcasts because it's a great medium. If you're listening to this, you already know that podcast, this is probably not the only podcast you're listening to if you're listening to the Climate Minute. So podcasts are cool. Tell people about it. Of course, you can pick up our show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, etc., etc. You, of course, can find us on iTunes. So we will close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So, DR, as always, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.